Side 4, Tempus Fugit, continuing on page 157. Raleigh never got away from that original idea. In 1929, the Park Commission was founded. Then, in 1935, the city added the Recreation Commission. In 1941, the city government began the first of several mergers and created from the two commissions the Raleigh Parks and Recreation Commission. The first members of the new Parks and Recreation Commission were Fred Dixon, John Miller, Wade Lewis, James or Jim Bynum, Mrs. Jesse Mills, J.J. Fallon, and Mrs. Alma Wynne Edgerton. It was about the same time that I was involved with a teen club sponsored by the Parks and Recreation Commission, and shortly after that, I was on the commission itself. In those days, we actually maintained two programs, one for the whites and one for the blacks. In my files is a 1956 planning worksheet carefully divided into recommendations for white program recommendations and Negro program recommendations. As strange as this looks now, it was not unusual for any city in 1956. The more unusual thing is that the city did conscientiously try to maintain good programs for both. The last line of the Negro program recommendations, under overall, reminded us that the community demands high-quality programs. We tried to make sure that both the whites and the blacks got high-quality programs. I like to think about all those years in the Parks and Recreation Commission and its successor, the Parks and Recreation Advisory Commission, in terms of what the commission and the city accomplished. For instance, we got the first recreation bond issue passed. In today's terms, the $750,000 we got is a piddly amount. But 40 years ago, $750,000 would buy something. In this case, it bought three community centers and a craft center in Pullen Park. As long as we are talking about bond issues, I need to mention that I think that one good measure of the citizens' attitude toward recreation is the fact that a bond issue for recreation has never failed in Raleigh. We also built a strong bond of cooperation between the city and the civic clubs and businesses. Between 1950 and 1961, Raleigh opened J.C. Park, Lions Club Park, and Kiwanis Park, all cooperative efforts. And over the years, it has fielded hundreds of little league ball teams with the names of sponsoring businesses stitched on the back of the uniforms. There was a large measure of initiative shown by the Parks and Recreation staff, too. For instance, the citizens of the Oakwood Mordecai area came to the Parks and Recreation Commission with a request that the city put a community center in their neighborhood. During that period, we were establishing a number of community centers around Raleigh. The problem with this particular one was that there was no vacant land available. The only thing we could do was buy land with houses on it and either refurbish the houses or raise them and build a community center on the site. We bought the land, planning to build a community center. However, Frank Evans discovered that the state was about to tear down a stately three-story, 12-room house to make room for a parking lot. The house was very near the property we just bought. Frank and his staff worked out a deal with the state and the owner of the house that let the state buy the land and let us have the house for the cost of moving it. Moving the house was no small feat. It weighed, I'm told, 1,200,000 pounds. But moving it was a lot cheaper than building a new building on the site. And, at the same time, we saved an historic house. The Tucker House had been built in 1914, and it remains a historic part of a historic district in Raleigh. Although it may not have seemed like it at the time, it seems now like we went from accomplishment to accomplishment, with very little to mar the memories of them. Even during the 60s, when a lot of cities were losing their recreation programs to arguments over integration, Raleigh's continued to grow. Our recreation facilities were integrated without incident. Well, there were a couple of incidents. One was when I was involved in dedicating a new pool at Chavis Park. I went into the locker room, changed into my swimsuit, went into the pool, came back, and found that my watch had been stolen. Another was when I went to a human relations meeting in East Raleigh. I went into the meeting, and when I came out, I discovered that somebody had stolen the woods from my golf bag. They had left the irons and had neatly arranged the covers from the woods beside my bag. These are integration incidents in the sense that they happened when integration was happening. I don't know whether the person or persons who stole the watch and the clubs were black or white. I do have a pretty good idea they were dishonest. However, incidents like that, infrequent and relatively trivial, don't distract from what was accomplished over the years. We have built a program that serves not only ballplayers and swimmers, but also had activities for the special populations, the hearing impaired, the visually impaired, the physically handicapped, and the mentally retarded. There are also programs for the very young and the very old. Raleigh's recreation program is as inclusive as any in the country. All of this has not gone unnoticed. Raleigh has one of the most visible and most honored parks and recreation programs in the country. When Frank Evans came from New Jersey in 1969, he created a 10-year plan. 6 years later, we were a National Parks and Recreation Gold Medal finalist. The next year, we won the award. In 1981, we were a finalist for our work with special populations. In 1983, we won the Gold Medal Award for programs for special populations. If I wanted to get really boring, I could go on and on about all the accomplishments of the city's recreation program, the Parks and Recreation Commission, the Department of Parks, and the Department of Recreation, and the several thousand people who worked on all of those. But you only have to go out to Pullen Park on a Sunday afternoon, or watch a little league game on almost any warm summer evening, or go to a craft show or storytelling day to get as good an idea of that. Or look at people like Jimmy Chambers. He was director of Parks and Recreation for 20 years, and he spent a lot of that time getting people to pull together and get things done. Jimmy, bless his heart, worked under at least one disadvantage. A few years after Jimmy was hired, the city hired a British gentleman named Edward J. Anderson as superintendent of parks and divided Parks and Recreation into the Department of Parks and the Department of Recreation. The two directors had a somewhat peculiar relationship. Jimmy called Edward Anderson Mr. Anderson. Mr. Anderson called Jimmy Jimmy. I also ought to mention Arnold Peterson and Ralph Andrews, our first two directors of the Department of Parks and Recreation. In fact, by the time Jimmy got here in 1950, Raleigh already had 16 parks with nearly 200 acres of land, a dozen playgrounds, and two recreation centers. Jimmy had a good basis to build on. And, of course, Frank Evans, who was city director of Parks and Recreation for 15 years. He's the one who came up with a description of Raleigh as the park with a city in it. He's also the one who provided the guidance that moved Raleigh from a comfortable but not too distinguished plateau to a vital and growing program. Frank inherited me when he came here, but we had no trouble learning to work together, although Frank did remind me on more than one occasion that I was appointed and not anointed. We held a lot of the same views about the place of recreation in the community. He took those views to the community with a missionary's zeal. There were, according to Frank, unbelievers, and he was determined to convert them. Frank's message was that the increase in leisure time was a mixed blessing. It was good so long as there was something good to do with it. It was the mission of the Parks and Recreation Department to help the citizens have the opportunity to enjoy their leisure time. And that meant all the citizens, no matter what their age, race, or physical or mental condition. When you get down to it, that's not very different from what we were taught at George Williams. Those are the kinds of things, and the kinds of people, I could talk your ear off about. There was, of course, an entirely different side, and that's the one that usually made the newspapers. There was, for instance, the flap over the Tanglewood Swim Club. It got a lot of publicity, and the fact that it did probably saved the city several hundred thousand dollars. This was a community pool built by people in the neighborhood buying shares in it. Then the neighborhood started changing, and the owners wanted to sell it to the city. Mayor Leitner wanted the city to buy it, so the city council approved the deal for $214,096, which was, as best I could tell from real estate agents who knew the area, about twice what it was worth. So Commission member Vernon Malone and I raised a sufficient stink to cause part of the council to reconsider, and they decided not to buy it. As they said in the paper, "We believe that sufficient questions have been raised at this time to warrant a reassessment of the council's position." As it turned out, the city spent $25,000 on repairing the pool and opened it the next year as a public pool. One of the upshots of that little fracas was a headline in the July 1, 1975 News and Observer. It said, "Fletcher's position may be in jeopardy." The story noted that my term as chairman of the Raleigh Parks and Recreation Board had expired and that the prospect of my reappointment was doubtful. It mentioned that the mayor and I had exchanged harsh words and predicted that my blowing the whistle on the Tanglewood Swim Club purchase would loom as a factor. In a remarkably biased bit of journalism, Rob Christensen described me as a short, bald man. However, he astutely added that I had an outgoing personality. But that was not the end of that story. On August 20, the headline said, "City gives Fletcher life term on board." And that story said that, "At Mayor Clarence E. Leitner's request, the city council named the outspoken and sometimes controversial Fletcher an honorary but voting member." So, thanks to the mayor, I was back on the board, as outspoken and sometimes controversial as I was. A couple of days earlier, I had accepted a position on the new Wake County Park and Recreation Board. Then I was re-elected chairman of the City Parks and Recreation Advisory Board. There is, I suppose, a lot of politics in any job where you deal with politicians. And I proved years ago that I wasn't a very good politician. Somehow I kept proving it. One time the phone rang and Jimmy Chambers' secretary said, "Mr. Chambers would like to speak with you." So I said, "Fine, have him call me," and I hung up. However, I managed to be chairman of the Parks and Recreation Advisory Board from 1956 until 1985, and we got a lot done. In the meantime, we encountered things like the Citizens Advisory Task Force and the use of park money to pay for streets to open up areas for developers and the loss of a line item on the tax bills for parks and recreation. And in 1985, I encountered a situation that made the papers with the indelicate headline, "Fletcher's Lifetime Term Axed." In another merger, the Parks and Recreation Advisory Board and the Greenway Commission had been merged. It wasn't something that either the Greenway Commission or our board wanted, but the City Council did. On the new board, I was relieved of my lifetime term and appointed to a new 2-year term. When the new group met, Leon Lucas and I were nominated for chairman. Leon won by a vote of 9-8. As of this writing, and without having read the morning paper, I am still on the board, now called the Parks and Greenway Board. I am still, I suppose, outspoken and sometimes controversial. I am still bald, but I haven't been short since I was 9 years old. I'm still convinced that recreation is a great source of good in a community, just like I was when I was at George Williams. When you get right down to it, it's amazing that I rubbed elbows with politicians and stayed there for nearly 50 years. You remember, I'm the one who ran for a second term on City Council on the platform that I had spent the first term learning how, and I wanted a second term to put what I had learned to use. Speaking bluntly seems to be my strong suit, and that doesn't always go down well with politicians. But it also didn't keep me from getting what I hope were my just deserts, and it was a sufficiently large spot in my life that it deserves to be told in some detail. In 1985, Jack Duncan asked me if I would be willing to go to Dallas to the NRPA convention to receive an award. I didn't really want to go, especially just to get a certificate of some sort. I asked him if the award was a group award. He told me that it wasn't, and he would really appreciate it if I'd go. So I agreed to go and take Margie with me. Since accepting awards is not something I do every day, I decided that I needed an acceptance speech. So I wrote a modest acceptance speech, 1 page long, and had it typed. I was ready when we got to the convention at the Fairmont, or at least I thought I was. When one of the early awards was given, the recipient walked up to the dais, took the award, said, "Thank you," and sat down. The audience applauded loudly, and the man at the table beside me said something like,
"That's a great acceptance speech. Way to go."
When my turn came, I wasn't sure that I dared to say much more than, "Thank you." But when Gene Turnbull, a former Robert M. Arts Award recipient, called my name, I decided that this moment was entirely too important to pass up. Mrs. Turnbull, in her gracious introduction, had mentioned that I had been a member of the Rally Board for 41 years, appreciative whistles from the audience, and chairman for 28 consecutive years, a muttered wow from one member of the audience. Then she handed me the plaque, a large one with my picture etched on it. I accepted the award from her, and after addressing the
chairman, distinguished guests, and fellow board members, I said,
"I was on the board for 41 years because they didn't know how to get rid of me. I was chairman for 28 years because I appointed the nominating committee."
Then I briefly recounted Margie's and my adventures in recreation beginning in 1936. When I mentioned that she was a graduate of the University of Illinois, they applauded. When I mentioned that I was a graduate of the University of North Carolina, they applauded again. They were a great audience. They laughed at all of the funny spots and a few that weren't too funny. And when I finished, they applauded long and loudly, probably out of all proportion to the couple of minutes of remarks that I had made. According to my written script, my closing words were,
"I thank you from the bottom of my heart."
What I actually said was,
"I love you all."
They were indeed my kind of people. It's been a long time since I first took my seat on the Parks and Recreation Board, but I've had a good time. I got a plaque after serving for 40 years, and, as I've mentioned and might again, I have a park named after me that I'm real proud of, and I was recognized by the NRPA with one of its most prestigious awards. I don't think I could ask for a whole lot more than that out of fun and games. Chapter 19, The Private Life of Fred Fletcher. Most of this book has been about what a celebrity would call his public life, the radio shows, the television station, recreation, and politics. That's because that is the part of my life I figured more people would be interested in, especially those people who are reading this to see what I said about them. However, I did, and do, have a private life. The fact that Margie and I have three children is some proof of that. And the small space devoted to it in this book is not to be taken as an assessment of its importance. However, as strange as some of the things that I did in public may have been, our home life was extremely normal. That's a tribute to Margie. She ran a very orderly house. We did the things that most of the families our age did, centered our social life on the kids' school lives, went to the beach for vacation, went to church on Sunday, and did our damnedest to raise the children as best we could. I would like to report here that I think we did right well. While I am remembering this, I am sitting in a room that was added onto the house that we moved into on July 11, 1944. It's 3001 Fairview Road. Almost everything that's happened to our family happened while we lived here. And stacked all over the house are boxes of mementos, reminders of all the living that has gone on here. For instance, there's a note from Fred Jr. He must have been 6 or 7 when he wrote it, because it's printed in a very childish scrawl in soft pencil. It says, "Dear Mother, I'm gone, but not forever. I will be back tonight or tomorrow. Love, Fred." Fred must have come back before dark, because neither Margie nor I can remember the incident. There's also the original paperwork on our mortgage on the home. The total price of the house was $13,500, and we financed $11,000 at 4.75% interest. The payments were $72.60 a month. And that, younger readers, is why they are called the good old days. It's amazing how a couple who, when they were first married, had eyes only for each other, number their years by events in the lives of their children. Almost everything we remember from those years can be referenced somehow to an event in the lives of Kay, Fred, or Bill. And I will admit that for a lot of the time, Margie was the designated parent. I was, like most of the men on my block, at work during the day. Unlike most of the men, my work day was from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. and often included a meeting in the evening. It was usually up to Margie to drop off the children, pick up the children, and, as they grew older, keep up with the children.
Margie had a creed that she followed that stood her in pretty good stead as she raised them. I'll pass it on for whatever good it might do some young mother. It is simply, ask the Lord for help, expect the best, prepare for the worst, and be grateful for anything in between. I suppose that one of the nicest things I can say about our three children is that they are individuals. In each one of them, I can see something of me and something of Margie. But each one of them grew up to be more than the parts of the parents. Kay, you've already met. She was the only 3-year-old shopper in the grocery store. She has, I suppose, her mother's independence of spirit, a trait that in Kay's early school years resulted in frequent confrontations with the system. She in school did not get along that well. But when she went to Needham Broughton High School in the 8th grade, she had a P.E. teacher who somehow changed Kay's whole attitude. She came home one day and announced that, after consulting with her P.E. teacher, she wasn't going to be naughty anymore. And she did very well in high school. I wish I remembered the name of the P.E. teacher. She should be held up to everyone as an example of what a teacher can accomplish. Unfortunately, all that I can remember is that she was a graduate of Slippery Rock. Kay was active in a lot of things in and out of school. She was in the Brownies and Girl Scouts, resulting in Margie being a Brownie mother and Girl Scout leader. She played the flute in the orchestra, and she did a radio program from Pullen Park called Platters by the Pool. As a child, Kay was always very direct. I remember going to the refrigerator for a can of beer one evening and finding that she had pasted a paragraph from her previous Sunday's Sunday school lesson on temperance on each can of beer. That impressed me to the point that I didn't buy any more cans of beer for quite a while. When Kay graduated from high school, her class received more than $1 million in scholarships. They were a smart bunch of kids, and the girls, Kay and her friends, were the smartest of the bunch. She went on to the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Now she's our Yankee child, living in New Jersey and working with General Electric as a software engineer. Our second child, Fred, was always doing something, sports, scouts, rock and roll, or tinkering on something. I have two strong memories of Fred's Little League career. The first is of watching a game that Fred's team was losing. Fred hadn't played yet, and his coach, George Parham, sent him up as a pinch hitter. He hit a home run. It didn't make a lot of difference in the game. They still lost, but it sure made his old dad proud. The other memory is a little more complicated. First, you have to know that because Fred was in the Little League, I had become a Little League coach. Actually, Elmo Johnson and I were co-coaches. The next thing you need to know is that although Margie was one of our biggest fans, she was not into the complexities of Little League baseball. That became obvious when she went to visit her brother in Detroit and saw the Yankees play Detroit. She immediately sent me a postcard telling me that the problem with my Little League team was that I left my pitchers in too long. She didn't know that I had finished my last game with the center fielder pitching. Fred went on to play baseball and football at Needham Broughton and was on Broughton's 1961 4A championship football team. He also played freshman football at State. In addition to his sports, Fred was active in the Boy Scouts all the way up to Eagle, had a rock and roll band that played around Raleigh, and had a 31 Ford coupe that he kept taking apart and putting back together. In fact, one of the memories that Margie has of young Fred is his standing in the kitchen with grease up to his elbows and holding an old carburetor in his hand. For some reason, he thought she would have the answer to the question, "What can I do with this?" Although all of the kids were involved with music, something they inherited from their father, I think Bill, our youngest, was the most musical. Bill played the cornet in high school band and sang in the chorus. He also had a major role in Carousel. Very early in his life, Bill showed a strong measure of determination. For instance, there was the Halloween when all the kids except Bill got to go trick-or-treating. Bill had a fever or something, so we decided he shouldn't go out. However, he didn't plan to miss his share of the loot. The next night, after he had gotten well, he put on his costume and went from house to house explaining that he was sick the night before. Did right well, too, as I recall.
When he was about 7, Bill brought home a blue ribbon from a YMCA swim meet. Since he was a determined but not particularly talented swimmer, I was rather anxious to see what the young man had won. Turned out that our son had been the superior competitor in the competition for the most unusual dive. Both Fred and Bill live in Raleigh, so Margie and I get to see them and our grandchildren often. We are, I suppose, as foolish as most grandparents about our grandchildren. I probably shouldn't give the idea that our whole life was wrapped up in our children, although for many years that would not be far from true. We had our friends, went to local events around town, often on tickets given me because of the radio station, and developed interests of our own. Margie, for instance, in addition to being a Girl Scout and Brownie leader and active in the PTA, was also president of the Junior Women's Club and actively involved in the club's projects. One of her major interests in the early 60s was very child-centered. She was one of the founders of the Raleigh Parent Youth League. I think the Parent Youth League was one of the better efforts that Margie was involved in. It's something that today's parents could probably use. The concept of the Parent Youth League was simple. There should be some sort of social standard that parents and kids could agree on. That way, you didn't have your eighth grader telling you that all the other parents let their eighth graders stay out until 11. The league published a little book entitled Off to a Good Start for a Happy Future that outlined basic social rules for junior high students. Here are a few examples. Rule number 3. Guests should be responsible for leaving the party on time, and parents should cooperate by calling for them promptly. Rule number 4. It is important that parents be at home when their young people entertain and that they drop in periodically on the party. Lights out has no place in a well-ordered party. Rule number 6. Guests should speak to the adult host or hostess on arriving and show appreciation to those giving the party by saying thank you before leaving. The book also suggested hours for various ages. For 7th graders, the party should be over at 9:30. For 8th graders, at 10. And for 9th graders, 10:30. On special occasions, 9th graders might be allowed to be out until 11. The book also took up subjects like when kids should actually begin dating, in the 8th grade in groups or double dating, and whether they should go steady. On this last question, the league suggested that it be discouraged, but recognized that it will continue to be a matter for the individual family. The league and its publication served a healthy purpose. It set recognizable standards for the young people and protected the parents from the manipulations that teenagers and preteens have practiced since prehistory. When I was going over all this stuff, I asked Fred Jr. if it bothered him that his mother was involved in making rules for his age group. He said that he never thought about it, since neither he nor the other children had any trouble staying within the rules. Best I can remember, they didn't. One of Margie's enduring interests is art. Somewhere along the way, she decided that she wanted to paint, so she studied oils with Nell Chadwick and watercolor with Betty Gallup. She sold some paintings, but she really prefers to give them away. Many of our friends have an original Margie Fletcher hanging in their homes. It's a tribute to Margie's talent that we have her very first oil hanging over the fireplace in our den, and it graces that wall very well. Another of her enduring interests is golf. That's something that we both still enjoy. She still plays like the P.E. major she was nearly 60 years ago. As I mentioned, most of my time was spent doing something connected with work. We were all involved in church, first as members of Hayes Barton Baptist Church, and then as charter members of the Ridge Road Baptist Church. Margie taught Sunday school, and I was in the choir and was the song leader in Sunday school. I also served on the finance committee, one of the more thankless jobs in any Baptist church. There was, however, one time when my musical talents came to my aid as a member of the finance committee. For any non-Baptists among the readership, I should probably mention that Baptist churches are organized congregationally. That is, the members of the church vote on everything, including, or especially, the budget. Usually, there is not a lot of conversation, but on the budget we were presenting that particular Sunday night,
there was some discussion on the money allocated to pay for a guest soloist. Several church members could not see the necessity for it. I, however, brought the point into focus by suggesting that the budget item be approved, or they would hear the likes of me doing the solos. The item was approved with no further discussion. There was one large side trip from my vocation. About the same time Margie was involved in the Parent Youth League, and after I had already moved to television, I started thinking that I should be doing something more. And for some reason that now escapes me, I decided that the something more should be a riding club. I suppose the fact that Bill was interested in horses at the time encouraged me, but I won't blame the Happy Trails Riding Club on him. In fact, when I first got the idea and was discussing it with people who were knowledgeable about horses, one trainer who had remarkable predictive powers told me that I was going to lose my ass on a horse farm. But it seemed like a good idea at the time. A.J. had bought a large plot of land for what is now Mont Lawn Cemetery. There was a house on the back part of the land, so I worked out a deal with him for the use of that part of the property. We shaped up the barn that was there, put in a septic tank, and bulldozed about 3 miles of riding trail, being careful to dodge the big trees. It turned out that about half a mile of the trail was on our neighbor's land, but he didn't mind. We hired Scotty Stevenson's next-door neighbor to teach the kids to ride, and some state college students to live on the property, feed the horses, and clean the stalls. I, as a gentleman horse farmer, would go to places like Pittsburgh to horse sales and dicker with other horse farmers for horses. And I bought 5 horses. Ultimately, we had 13, since I was repeatedly victimized by John Newell of Pittsburgh, a much better horse trader than I am. One horse, named Preacher, was so swaybacked that when you looked at him from the side, he looked a lot like a capital U. But he was an easy horse to ride. And there was a pinto who was smart enough to lift the latch on the gate. I thought that was a cute trick until I got a call at home early one morning telling me that the horses were grazing on the field at Miller's Municipal Airport. I took off from home and went over there. As reported, there were all of the Happy Trails horse farm horses grazing by the runway. My gentleman horse farming experience had not, at that point, included rounding up a herd of horses from a wide open field. I would walk slowly and carefully toward them. They would walk slowly and carefully away. It didn't take long to figure that I'd never get the horses back to the stable that way. I went back to the barn and got a bucket of oats, and that did the trick. I got one of them interested in the oats. When that one began following me, the rest just came along. However, it was more than a little embarrassing leading them across the 4 lanes of Highway 401 while one of the men from Mont Lawn stopped traffic. A mule dealer from Apex named Seymour decided for some reason that the Happy Trails Riding Club needed a jackass. So one day he brings one over and drops him off. The jackass added a little local color, but it caused 2 problems. The first is that he was attracted to most of the horses in the yard, and after the riding horses had had a hard day on the trail, they would have to dodge the jackass who followed them around with amorous intentions. Even worse was the fact that the jackass had a bray like a diesel engine on a clear, cold night. Since the horse farm was adjacent to Mont Lawn, it really didn't help matters when it hee-hawed during the most solemn parts of the funeral services. There were some complaints about that. Finally, I had to get rid of the jackass. In fact, I had to get rid of all the Happy Trails horses after about 2.5 years. The trainer's prediction, "You're going to lose your ass on that, Mr. Fletcher," had come true, and I decided to look for another diversion. I gave the horses to Meredith College, where I'm sure they were happier anyway, and I closed down the riding club. But while it was an expensive experience, it was not an unpleasant one. I got involved with the Capital Horsemen's Association, and was even elected president of it 1 year. I worked with other horsemen on developing a competition, and I got the biggest crowd on record to a Capital Horsemen's Association meeting, even though it was a dark and stormy night. The speaker was the aforementioned John Newell from Pittsburgh, and his subject was How to Buy Horses. There was one other distinctive benefit to owning the riding club. My 5 horses provided some of the best fertilizer you could find. Considering the cost, it should have been. I used it on my vegetables and flowers.
One of those flowers, a rose, won me a blue ribbon in a citywide rose show. I suppose there is some deep philosophical truth in winning a blue ribbon for a rose grown using manure produced from a money-losing horse farm, but I've never been able to find it. The whole Fletcher family survived the demise of the Happy Trails horse farm, just as we did a lot of other disappointments over the years. I, for instance, was disappointed when the kids quit inviting me to school to tell fairy tales to their classmates, but I guess the kids at Broughton High didn't have much of a taste for fairy tales. On the whole, our family life was, as I said, just normal family life. Mother, father, three children, so busy most of the time that large chunks of time just flew by, and suddenly the children were grown up. Chapter 20. The party of the first part loves all the parties of the second part. On August 26, 1975, the newspapers in Raleigh carried the story of my retirement from Capital Broadcasting and WRAL-TV. A lot of people expressed surprise, but nobody was more surprised than I was. But my surprise had come a few months before, on a Saturday in April. I was in Burlington playing in the seniors' golf tournament, and my father and my brother, Frank, were back in Raleigh making decisions that would affect the rest of my life. A lot of what happened between AJ and me then is public knowledge, if not public record. The rest of it, a very difficult time between my father and me and my family, is private and family and should stay that way. I guess this chapter is my view of what those who were interested already know. In April of 1975, A.J. Fletcher was 87 years old. I was 64. He was, as he always had been, chairman, chief executive officer, and treasurer of the company. I was president and chief operating officer. There were other Fletchers around, too. My son Bill was producing television commercials at the station. My nephew Jim Goodman had joined the station's management in 1968. When I left for Burlington, I was looking forward to several more years before retiring and to building a great deal of security for my family. When we got back from Burlington, Frank came over to talk to Margie and me and told us that AJ had decided that none of that was going to happen. It seems that, at AJ's instigation, Frank and Jim had been consulting with tax consultants in New York, and while I was playing golf in Burlington, they were typing up the papers that would distribute AJ's stock primarily to Jim and Ray Goodman. A couple of weeks later, when the papers were filed with the FCC, the News and Observer carried the story under the headline, "No Changes Expected at WRAL." This wasn't one of the NNO's greatest examples of journalistic accuracy. Not only were changes expected, they were essentially made. When Frank sat down in our living room, he prefaced his speech with the fact that I had performed above and beyond the call of duty. And on that laudatory tone, he proceeded to tell Margie and me that I and my family had essentially been cut out of AJ's will, and that Jim and Ray Goodman would have controlling interest in Capital Broadcasting. It was obvious that, since I had just over 3% of the stock in the company, my own future was not secure. So I asked Frank to get me a written proposal from AJ that would define my position in the company. He came back on Friday with a proposal that, in my opinion, defined my position as a ward of the company, not a role that I saw myself in after being with and managing the station for 36 years. When Margie and I were first married, we sat on the front steps of AJ's house and listened to him paint bright pictures of our future. It was his prediction that we could have whatever we were willing to work for and wanted. For 36 years, we'd been working for it, and we certainly wanted and expected more than we were hearing at this point. By the first of the next month, the situation had moved out of our living room and into the lawyer's office. The Civil War, which they say turned brother against brother, had nothing on what was happening in the Fletcher family in 1975. Jesse Helms, as most of you know, talks a great deal and generally knows what kind of effect his talk is going to have. However, he started a phone call to me during this time with perhaps the worst choice of words he could make. "Fred," he said, "let me speak to you like a brother." Thinking of my recent conversations with Frank, I told Jesse that the last thing I needed was one more damn brother. This thing went back and forth for months with my lawyers talking to Frank and his associates. Finally, it was, after a fashion, resolved.
I resigned, or was resigned, from WRAL-TV and Capital Broadcasting. I was paid to give up certain rights and benefits, and AJ and I came to a financial understanding. I still don't know what caused it all, why, after 36 years, AJ decided to eliminate me and my family from the company. I had, after all, been a part of WRAL since they first threw the switch on the 250-watt AM station. And I had worked side by side with AJ when we fought the TV grant battle with WPTF. We had certainly had our differences, and he had more than once proved that he was the boss. But we had built a successful broadcast company, an AM station, an FM station, a TV station, and a news network. I was, and still am, proud of that. My cousin, Jim Daniel, thinks that the problem was, at least in part, politics. I had, in my youth, been a liberal, and compared to some, I still was. But generally, my life has followed the old proverb that the young man who is not a liberal has no heart, while the old man who is not conservative has no brains. On most issues, I think, AJ and I were not so far apart. But I am not, as I have proven, a politician. I'm a broadcaster. It's possible that AJ just didn't want to entrust what he had built to a broadcaster, even though what he had built, and I had built with him, was a broadcast company. I never did find out what his reasons were. The best thing I can say about the whole affair was that it never did go to court. I was, as I told AJ, prepared to take it to court if necessary. But it was settled under terms that, while they may not have made anyone happy, satisfied everyone sufficiently that a settlement could be made. Perhaps the saddest part was reading the legal document, the long white paper with a red stripe down the side, that defined my relationship with my father. In one place it says, "Whereas A.J. loves and respects Fred and all of the parties of the second part, A.J. and Fred have now agreed that family harmony and their love and respect each for the other is more important than their grievances, and that the slate should be marked clean, each recognizing and declaring that at no time hereafter will either have a claim against the other." I'm sure that AJ did love and respect Fred and all the parties of the second part, but it's a hell of a thing to have to read about in a memorandum of understanding and agreement. Perhaps I should have been forewarned. In 1965, AJ's Christmas card had a poem that was full of either irony or prophecy. It began, "When I am 80, I expect to wear a green chapeau on my frosty hair." And it ended, "I'll be an old gentleman of verve and vim, and I'll change my will on the slightest whim." It wasn't too long after we had come to our understanding that AJ died. While he was in the hospital, I visited him and sat with him under the watchful eyes of his heirs.